For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Anyway, we've been studying the Bible thematically, looking at some of the many questions that God asks individuals, both in the Old and New Testament, just pondering, you know, why would the God who knows everything already, the God who doesn't need advice from anyone, why would he ask people like us so many questions? And we're getting different answers to that reflection. It's clear that a lot of times when God asks people questions, it's a vehicle to prompt them to have a little bit more self-reflection and to realize misbeliefs they may have, etc. We saw last week that sometimes God asks questions rhetorically. It's not really a question at all. It's a statement. A statement of to alert or warn someone of a danger that they're in. Sometimes the questions God asks just seem super straightforward, you know. And this one that we're going to look at today is that way. You know, when I was a very young Christian, I was a Bible virgin. I'd never read the Bible. So I was reading the Bible, beginning to read the Bible, and it was coming alive to me. And I heard a teacher say, you know, the Bible is, you know, like it's shallow enough for babies to wade in and it's deep enough for elephants to drown in. Boy, I really like that. That just resonated with my own experience that I could read a passage and get something out of it always pretty straightforwardly. But the more you look at a passage and the more that you see how it connects with the rest of the Bible, the more that there is there. Pretty soon you're like an elephant that's drowning in it. I think this passage that contains this question is that way. The question is, what do you want me to do? That's pretty straightforward. Here's the passage in which that question is asked. It says, then they, that's referring to Jesus and his disciples, came to Jericho. They were on their way to Jerusalem to celebrate one of the Old Testament festivals. And as Jesus was leaving Jericho with his disciples and a large crowd, a blind beggar named Bartimaeus, and then Mark tells his non-Jewish audience who didn't know Hebrew, you know, that means son of Timaeus, Bar is son. Well, this blind beggar named Bartimaeus was sitting by the road. When he heard that it was Jesus the Nazarene, he began to cry out and say, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. Many were sternly telling him to shut up. That's what be quiet means. But he kept crying out all the more, son of David, have mercy on me. And Jesus stopped and said, call him here. So they called the blind man, saying to him, take courage, stand up, he's calling for you. Throwing aside his cloak, old Bart jumped up, came to Jesus, and answering him, Jesus said, what do you want me to do for you? And the blind man said to him, Rabboni, which just means teacher, I want to regain my sight. And Jesus said to him, go, your faith has made you well. And immediately he regained his sight and began following Jesus on the road. That's pretty straightforward, right? And you can see how the question that Jesus asks is kind of the climax or the hinge point of this little passage. Everything kind of leads up to that question and everything kind of flows down out from that question. What do you got? You got a blind beggar who calls out to Jesus. Jesus talks to him. He asks them, what do you want? He tells them what he wants. He gives them what he wants. And they keep going to Jerusalem. And that's all true. And yet, it's a wading pool in that sense, but it's also a pretty deep pool. And I would like to have us look more closely at this passage and see how it really gives us quite a lot of insight into three different things. One is who Jesus is. Probably didn't see too much there at first glance. It actually provides us with a beautiful picture of what the Bible calls salvation. And it also dishes up some really important lessons in the area of prayer. So let's just walk back through one at a time, pondering the same passage, the same question from these perspectives. First of all, yeah, it gives us really, I think, three distinct insights into who Jesus is. Let's bear in mind that this passage was an eyewitness account. Mark, we learn from the early writings of the church, was really writing Peter's memoirs. So Peter was here. And one of the things that you'll notice if you read Mark's gospel, it has these little incidental details, like, you know, Jesus had him sit down in the green grass. Well, the grass wasn't always green. It was just the spring of the year. Jesus was asleep with his head on a cushion. Here, the man is named by name, Bartimaeus, because Peter, for whom Mark is writing, remembers these details. So the first and most important thing this passage teaches us about who Jesus is that it tells us that he is the promised Messiah. You may not have noticed that as you went through that at first. Let's remember that this was a very public setting, multitudes of Jewish people on their way to a Jewish festival. And it's in that very public setting that this blind beggar calls out to Jesus. And you remember, he notes that it's Jesus the Nazarene, the Jesus who comes from Nazareth. But the man calls out saying, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." That is significant. And the people in the crowd would have known the significance of that term, because Son of David was a title for the Messiah, the promised king and ruler that all the Old Testament prophets talked about. And so this man is publicly raising the question of Jesus's identity by calling him the Son of David. You will see that in almost all of these kind of incidents in the Gospel of Mark, that's what Mark is focusing on. Who is this guy really? So that issue, is he the Messiah, is raised. Now, the Jewish people in this public setting knew a lot of things about what the Messiah would do when he came. And they all knew this passage from Isaiah 35, which was 700 years before Jesus came. Isaiah the prophet says, "Then when the Messiah comes, the eyes of the blind will be opened and the ears of the deaf will be unstopped. Then the lame will leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute will shout for joy." And so Isaiah predicts that they'll be able to recognize the Messiah because he will perform four different distinct kinds of unparalleled healing miracles. And of course, we just read from an eyewitness one of those healing miracles, the immediate restoration of sight to this man. If you read the Gospel of Mark, you'll see that he narrates incidences of all four of these kinds of healings. And so what's going on here? In a public setting, the question is raised, is Jesus the Son of David? Is he the Messiah? What does Jesus do in response? In a very public setting, is that he fulfills this prophecy to answer to the people there, the Jewish people there, that he's saying, "Yes, I am that person, the Son of David." And what an interesting kind of Messiah he is. The God's rightful ruler and king over the whole world. We see in this passage that Jesus, the Messiah, is very interested in little people as individuals, right? Did you notice the contrast between the way that most of the people responded to this man requesting Jesus's attention and the way Jesus responds to this man's request for attention? Most of the people are like, "Shut up." You know, maybe they're like, you know, you need a look. But of course, he wouldn't have been able to see that if they were threatening to backhand him. You have to understand that this guy was on the bottom rung of Jewish society. He was a blind beggar. And that, see, he would have been socially on the bottom rung of the poverty ladder. And because of the false theological teaching of this day, most people would view him as someone who must have committed a terrible sin, and that his blindness was God's punishment for his sin. And so they're like, shut up. You're not worthy of his attention. And Jesus is like, he stops when he hears. He says, Jesus said in another passage, my sheep hear my voice and I know them. And he heard this man address him as son of David. I heard that. He stopped, said, bring him here. I want to talk to him. And he was extremely interested in what this man, who this man was and what he wanted. We live in a very different culture, you know, with regard to this. People who are important, they don't have time for the little people. And people often talk about how alienating American culture is, that we're all being mass processed, that we're numbers being mass processed with form letters, and a lot of that's really true. And unfortunately, even the church has often communicated this perspective on God and on Jesus. You know, you got a few really important people, they don't have time for anyone else. And you just kind of, you can grow up feeling like, you know, God is busy. Jesus is busy, and we eventually come to hope that he will be busy so that he won't see us. But underneath that really is a longing that my life does matter to God. Does he care? Well, here's one of the many ways the Bible answers that question. Yeah, he cares, and he's very interested in you personally. And he wants to have a relationship with you that is fully personal. The Bible says that the real God is both personal and infinite. Because he's infinite and personal, he can give his full attention to each and every person, even at the same time. That's pretty mind-blowing. So Jesus is a Messiah who's very interested in little people. And then, to me, even cooler, is that we learn in this passage that Jesus is also a Messiah who's already inclined to bless people. You know, the question that Jesus asked to this guy is not, what do you want now? Right? That would be a question of exasperation. That would be a question of annoyance. That would be a question of someone who's grudgingly going to give. What do you want now? You ever say that? You ever had that said to you? And yet, the question, what do you want me to do for you, clearly implies that he wants to do something for this man. And his actions bear it out, right? He's already inclined to give to this man. And think about the man's first statement to him, have mercy on me. And Jesus's question to him is a response to that request. You know, mercy means kindness shown to the undeserving. That's what mercy is. The origin of mercy is not in the worth of the asker. The origin of mercy is in the kindness of the giver. He's already inclined to show mercy. I think this is one of the deepest things about the heart of God that is most difficult for us to understand, and I can't belabor it here this morning, but I suspect that the worst blight in our fallen souls is this deep-seated sense that something within us has to get God's attention to incline him to do for us. You notice that Jesus did not say, what have you done for me lately? We say that a lot, out loud or silently, right? And see, that's quid pro quo. I may do something for you if you've already done something for me that puts me in your debt, or that now there's something about you and what you've done that maybe inclined me to do something for you. It's just mercy is for the undeserving. It's not anything. And remember who this guy was and how the crowd would have viewed him as a totally wretched super sinner. It's not. Jesus doesn't say, anyway, it's not what I do that moves God to bless me. It's not even that my faith makes God inclined to bless me. The value of your faith is that it simply enables you to receive the blessing God already wants to give you. God is a giver who delights in giving. We don't believe that to a profound level. So anyway, that's pretty cool to see in this passage, the insights we get into who Jesus is. But there's more than that. As I said earlier, this passage is a historical account about a real man who had real blindness, who got a real physical sight healing. And yet it is more than that. I'm convinced that it is like most or even all of Jesus's miracles, simultaneously a picture of something far greater. This is why John, the author of the fourth gospel, the Gospel of John, calls Jesus's miracles signs. And over again, he narrates a real historical event, a real supernatural act that Jesus did for an individual that met one of their physical needs, just like this passage that we just read, and insists that it's a historical event. And yet at the same time, John says that was also a sign. The sign signifies something beyond itself. It is simultaneously an illustration and a validation of something far greater. It is indeed a symbolic act that reveals Jesus's unique ability to meet the spiritual needs, which are greater, of all people, not just this. This is a picture, as a symbol of this. And he's always connecting these two. And so that entitles us to look at this passage and ask, how does it portray, how is it a sign? Well, I don't think it's that difficult to answer that question. On the one hand, we know that the man's plight was physical blindness, right? And physical blindness was it's a terrible plight in itself, right? To be deprived of one of your five senses, to navigate through physical reality. I've always felt like, you know, if I have to be deprived of any of my senses, I hope that it won't be my sight, because I just feel like that, you know, that would be really rough. Okay? And in this culture, where there were no beeper crosswalks, there were no seeing eye dogs, there was no social network to help people, blind people, get jobs or to make a living. Well, you see where that leads. That leads to a guy like this sitting on his jacket begging. They were very vulnerable to exploitation and abuse. Really, in many ways, one of the most pathetic situations in an ancient culture. And this really, and you see it over and over again in the Gospel of John, this is really a picture of an affliction that God says afflicts all of us. That all of us, the Bible says, we come into this world spiritually blind. That there is a whole dimension of reality, and that this dimension is where, you know, where is has to do with who God is, has the answers about who I am, has to do with the answers of what's the purpose of my life, what's the meaning of human history. And we come into this world blind, cut off from those answers, that portion of reality, and that renders us. See, we look around and we say, that person's disabled, this person's normal. No, when God looks at you and me and compares us to the way he made us to be, we are all profoundly disabled. And this is the most profound disability. And this renders us lost. This renders us without answers that we desperately need. This renders us vulnerable to real deception. And so when Jesus said, just right before he healed another man in John 9 and John 8, he preceded it by connecting these dots. He says, I'm the light of the whole world. The world here means all humanity. I'm the sole source of spiritual sight for the whole of humanity. He who follows me will not walk in darkness. Won't be blind anymore, but will have the light of spiritual life. He's like, the bad news is you're blind as a bat spiritually. The good news is I want to and can enable all of you to see. And how cool it is. You think about this man. And so his healing, the restoration of his sight, is likewise a picture of what the Bible calls salvation. Salvation means rescue. It also means healing. In fact, in verse 51, when Jesus says to the man, your faith has, in the Greek, it's your faith has saved you. Even that, I believe, is the suggestion on Jesus' part. This is about more than just a physical healing. Think what it would have been like for that guy to walk up to Jesus, have this brief interchange, and suddenly, immediately, remember Mark loves to say immediately, immediately, he could see. And what is the first thing he sees? Jesus, right? Because he's been having this conversation. Bring him up here. He didn't just want to, I don't have time. I'm going to Jerusalem. And, the guy just has an impersonal healing. They're having a face-to-face conversation so that when the man can see, the first thing he sees is Jesus. And then in light of Jesus, he sees everything else. And that really is what a salvation is to a great degree. Salvation is having God restore your spiritual sight, first and foremost, so that you can see Jesus for who he really is. And God for who he is. And then in light of that, in light of Jesus, who is the light of the world, to begin to see these other things that I mentioned, who you are, what your purpose is, what the meaning of history is. He begins to connect those dots for us. And so Paul, reflecting on this salvation, says, God who said, light shall shine out of darkness. That's a reference to Genesis 1, when God created the universe. There's a point where he spoke and there was light. He's the same God who shines into our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. That's what salvation is, having your spiritual sight given to you through Christ. Now having a faculty by which you can navigate in spiritual reality. And then there's the question, what was the guy's part in this? What did he have to do to receive his sight? What do we have to do to receive our salvation? Well, you remember that the man didn't do that much, right? I mean, he cried out to Jesus with what Jesus wound up telling him was an utterance of faith, right? Because before he goes away, he says, I just want you to remember, on your part, it was your faith. And what was his faith? It's simply that he cried out to Jesus, deciding to put his money on the fact that he's the son of David, deciding to put his money on the, I think I'm going to trust that you're the Messiah, and simply asking for mercy. You saw how the account didn't go. It didn't go like this. Jesus said, bring him to me. The guy said, he says to Jesus, what do you want me to do for you? I want to regain my sight. Well, dude, why don't we set an appointment now for next year? And when you get off the porn, and when you quit drinking, and when you clean up your life, you sinner, then we'll revisit this question. He did not say to the guy, how many times have you been to synagogue in the last year? How come you weren't on your way down to the festival like the rest of us? When are you going to get religious? Then we might consider that. No. He asked for undeserved mercy. And the moment that he turned to Jesus personally in faith, he was healed. And that is a beautiful picture of what the Bible says. We do not get salvation from God because we become religious, or because we first cleaned up our lives. We get salvation from God as an absolutely free gift, and the only part that we play in it is simply to ask in simple faith. That's what this portrays. And that's what Paul says in Ephesians 2, for it's by grace, that means God's undeserved charity, that you've been saved through faith. And that refers to salvation, is not of yourself. You didn't cook your own salvation up. You don't contribute anything to your actual salvation. God does that. It's the gift of God. It's not as a result of any works that you perform. so that no one can boast. This man did not go away, and we'll see this in a moment, saying, man, I healed myself today. I did something awesome. I mean, we'll see how he went away from this. So that no one should boast. So, you know, there's some of you here today who are spiritually blind. You still abide in spiritual blindness. And you say that, well, that's pretty offensive for you to say that to me. Well, I don't say it. God says it's true. You're blind as a bat. You do not have God's Holy Spirit in your heart. You are not spiritually alive, and you are fundamentally crippled from living life the way God designed you to live it. And here's Jesus right in front of you through this passage saying, I'll give you spiritual life. I'll make you alive to God. I'll do it right now. And what is your part? Your part is to say, I need that and I want that. And I don't deserve it. Now, why would you be unwilling to call out to Jesus? Maybe like I did, where my prayer was, if you even exist, then I want this. And he gave this to me when I prayed that way. If you exist, I want to know you. Why would you be unwilling to say that to Jesus? I kind of don't understand. What do you got to lose? Could gain everything. Well, that's pretty cool, I think. All of these miracles in the Gospel of Mark are like this. Let's finish up here this morning by asking that third question. What lessons can we learn about prayer through this passage? Because really, that's kind of what's going on here. We don't often think of it that way when we read these passages in the Gospels, but when people speak to Jesus, that's prayer. That's what prayer is, speaking to Jesus. And so when this guy calls out, have mercy on me, son of David, that's prayer. When Jesus says, what do you want me to do for you? And he answers, that's prayer. The whole thing is an answer to prayer. I see at least four things. People came up with more after the first meeting, just not that you should be competitive, but just so you know. Here's something I think is pretty cool, that receiving answers to prayer from Jesus is a really powerful motivator. Right? I mean, Jesus said, he immediately regained his sight, he got his prayer answered, and he began following Jesus on the road. It doesn't say that Jesus said, and now that I've done this for you, that you really should follow me. It doesn't say that the disciples began to, guilt trip him. Dude, you need to come. He was not recruited. He spontaneously wanted to follow Jesus. Why? Well, it's pretty obvious, right? Why, right? Jesus answered his prayer. And in Luke's account, in Luke 18, he adds this little tidbit. Immediately he regained his sight and began following Jesus, glorifying God. What does that mean? It means that he was like, following, was like, dude, I can see! And people were like, so what's the big deal? You don't understand, I couldn't see earlier, but now I can see it, he did it. Okay, this is a picture of spiritual vitality. Right here. People who have the joy of the Lord, who spontaneously and voluntarily want to follow Jesus, and want to just point out how cool he is. And in this case, it's clearly because he just had his prayer answered. And we should think about that. This is why we see each and every new Christian is like this. Each and every new Christian that I've ever met wants to follow Jesus, at least at that point. And they're pretty excited. Why? Because they were blind and they just got enabled to see. Right? And, young Christians, they don't know any better than to just ask Jesus for all kinds of things. Right? I mean, they ask him for everything. They ask him to help them find their lost car keys. They ask him for everything. Right? And they don't get what they request every time, but they ask about a lot and they get a lot of answers. And that's partly why they're so motivated and joyous. But see, then they grow up, so to speak. And what happens with most Christians as they go on is they begin to want to protect themselves from not getting the answers to their prayers. And so, because there are not all prayers get answered. We all know that. And this passage doesn't say they will be. But a lot of us, if you look at your own Christian life, as time has gone on, a lot of us, we ask Jesus for less and less. And a big part of it is because we don't want to be disappointed. And one of the things that we forfeit is this. We forfeit the privilege of having Him answered prayer, not all of our requests, but answered prayer ought to be something that's very recent in our dealings with Jesus. He says we should pray to Him like a child prays to his parents, talks to his parents. I don't know about you, but if you've had small kids, I got small grandchildren, they ask for all kinds of things. Right? And what kind of arrangement would it be if I said to my 4-year-old granddaughter, hey, let's just have an agreement. You can ask me for one thing a month if it's really important. Right? I mean, that just is like so wrong. And God's always saying, I'm your father. And you'd be like little children. You come to me with everything. Maybe the best thing you could do coming out here today is just begin to ask Jesus for everything, every need that you see in your life. Well, closely connected to this is another lesson, which is that Jesus wants us to tell Him specifically what we want Him to do for us, right? I mean, that's the outrageous thing about this passage. Jesus, the Messiah, says to the guy, remember the guy's prayer begins very general, right? Very general, very spiritual. Son of David, have mercy on me. But when Jesus is talking to him, Jesus wants specifics. What do you want me to do for you? He wanted to know specifically. And it was in response to that specific request, as a token of his love, that he granted him what he wanted specifically. And so, in the same way that older Christians tend to pray, ask for less to protect themselves from disappointment, I think that older Christians often pray less and less specifically. And I include myself in this tendency where we're just praying safe prayers like, Lord, you know, may your will be done. Lord, may you be honored. And it feels spiritual, and sometimes it is, but often it's safe and vacuous. And we should be more specific. Again, a child comes to their parents with specific requests wherever they sense need. A little while ago, I was at Lowe's, and my gate latch had busted, and I am so incompetent in this area. So I was over there at Lowe's, staring down the hardware aisle, just thinking, oh, crap, man, I don't even know where to begin. And the thought came to my mind, you should ask Jesus for help. And the next thought was, you idiot. You don't ask for that. But I thought, I'm going to ask. I'm just sitting there, I'm not praying out loud, obviously. I'm just like, Jesus, I need help. I don't want to spend my whole Monday on this stupid gate latch. And I swear to God that the instant that I finished that little prayer, someone was tapping on my shoulder, and I turn around, and it's my friend John Nice, who knows that store better than any employee. He says, what are you looking for? I felt like I'd seen a ghost. I just told him, dude, man, gate latch is busted. I don't know what. He took me around by hand and showed me everything I need, gathered it up, walked me to the checkout line. I thought, that was pretty cool. And I got home, and the next thing you know, I'm in front of the gate with my little stupid toolbox, and I'm like, oh, crap. And I was like, Lord. And guess who pulls up right at that moment was John Nice. He pulls up, and he says, I didn't have nothing to do today anyway. And he fixed my gate latch. Now, you could say, well, you know, that was all coincidence. And, you know, you can say that if you want. I mean, that's your misfortune. And you can say, you know, that God doesn't always do that. And that's right, he doesn't always do. Why? But why would I deprive myself of the delight that came from making that specific request, even though part of me was like, don't do that. Right? So we should just think about that. I think, just to add one more point here, I think that sometimes we don't ask him specifically because we already know, we're pretty sure that what we want really isn't what he wants. He'd still rather hear you ask. Because that's honest. And because he can work with you when you're asking him, even though you suspect this is not his way. That's way better than just like, whatever you want, Lord. I was in a very painful situation several years ago, and I decided I'm going to, you know, pray all night, which of course I didn't do. And I prayed to the Lord for a few minutes, and I just realized, you know, this is not good. Because what I basically was praying is, Lord, I want you to overturn that person's freedom of choice now so that I don't have to hurt anymore. Okay, and so, but that's basically what I realized. That's what I want. And the Lord wanted me to pour that out to him. Then he was able to work with me, not that night, but as time went on and this situation continued to be painfully present, he worked with me gradually to help me see what I did want that he wanted to give me in this situation. But if you just take the super spiritual route and say, well, whatever you want, Lord, you deprive yourself of the privilege of having the living Christ through his Spirit teach you how to pray about certain things so that he can answer you. That's pretty important. Here's a third lesson. Faith is important here, right? I mean, Jesus, after all, makes it clear to the guy, your faith has made you well. Your faith has saved you. So there was something that the man brought to the table that was critical. I don't know about you, but 8 years ago when I did this series, I deliberately avoided this whole passage. And the main reason was it seems too much like one of those passages that the healer dealers use. You know, where like, you know, if you've got enough faith, you can get anything you ask for. Or, you know, even that faith is this like magic power that you've got that you can change reality through your faith. It sort of feels that way when Jesus says, go, your faith has made you well. Of course, he's not saying that. That's not what he means. He does not mean that the man healed himself. The passage is totally clear. Jesus healed him. He was completely unable to heal himself. What Jesus is pointing out is, you participated in this by coming to me in faith. And so the problem, so we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We know how the healer dealers misuse this passage, but let's not miss the point that he's making. And the point is that faith is not a magical power that's within you, that if you conjure it up and you squeeze it out, then you'll get what you want or you'll change reality. That's not what faith is. And in the Bible, it's always clear that it's the object of your faith that matters, far more than the size of your faith. Jesus was the one that said, it's not how much faith you have, right? Mustard seed faith, if it's placed in the right object. Faith, and you see it in this passage, is simply trusting Jesus enough to bring your need to him, right? And say, help me with this. And clearly it involves trusting that he wants to help, trusting that he's wise, trusting that he's able. And so we do, that's all that it takes. Whether it's your spiritual blindness, whatever it is, you just have to have enough faith, which everyone has, to bring it to Jesus personally and say, I'm in need here and I need you in this situation. Some of us refuse even on that level to come in faith, and we deprive ourselves of what he wants to give us. The good news, you can always then change your mind and decide to come to him in faith. There's a last lesson, well, that I saw on prayer, and that is that even the prayer that this man uttered is probably pretty good for us to think about. He said, Rabboni, I want to regain my sight. And so we learn here, among other things, of course, that this guy was not born blind. The word in the Greek for regain my sight is the word anablepo, which means literally to see again. So this man had been able to see and then somehow tragically lost his sight and missed it sorely and was asking, Lord, I want to regain my sight, restore my sight to me. And I just think that is a... That's a really great prayer for Christians to pray. In the spiritual sense, you know, that when you received Christ, then God gave you spiritual sight and you were able to perceive Jesus and what God's like, etc. But you know as well as I do that it's easy to lose your spiritual sight. It's easy to contract spiritual glaucoma, spiritual cataracts. And we can lose our spiritual sight, not our salvation, but our spiritual sight, you know, by just simple neglect of the things of God. We can lose our spiritual sight by a hard-hearted attitude toward God. We can lose our spiritual sight, truly, for me, just by trudging around in this world system every day. It brings its own coating of spiritual dirt and grime that tends to obscure my vision of spiritual things. And so it is an excellent prayer priority to say to the Lord on a regular basis, maybe even daily, I want to regain my sight. I can't, this is the thing you learn, you can't just flip a switch and regain your own spiritual sight. It has to be given to you by the Lord, just like it was given to you when you received Christ. But he delights in restoring our sight if we ask him to. Well, look at some of these passages as we finish up here this morning. We should ask him regularly that he restore our sight of his grace. So Paul, writing to the Ephesian Christians, who were most of them older, grounded Christians, he says, I pray that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened so that you will know what is the hope of your calling. And he says, so that you may get a fresh glimpse of the bright future that God has in store for you. That you may know what are the riches of the glory of God's inheritance in the saints. That's a staggering statement. What he's saying is, I'm praying that you get a fresh glimpse of how precious you are to God. You're his inheritance. And he says, I'm also praying that your eyes would be open to see again the surpassing greatness of the power of God that's at work toward you who believe in him. How well endowed you are with the power of God. You think it would make a difference to have a fresh revelation of the brightness of your future, how precious you are to God and the power of God that's at work on your behalf? It makes a difference for me. Need to ask for that regularly. We need to ask God, help. I want to regain my sight with your word. Everyone here knows how the word of God can be alive and the word of God can be dead, right? And so the psalmist says, Lord, open my eyes that I may behold wonderful things from your word. People talk a lot about methods of Bible study, and I'm all about a lot of that. Here's the main thing. Right here, that we so often just forget to do. Every time we know we're going to expose ourselves to the Word of God, a teaching, Bible study, we should always just turn to the Lord for a few seconds and say, open my eyes, that I may behold wonderful things in your Word. I spent some time studying and preparing for this teaching. I won't lie about that. But I believe that the most important preparation by far was saying to the Lord when I started, and through preparation, open my eyes that I can see. And I believe he answered that prayer. And that, to me, that's the delightful thing about preparing to teach. That's just, I'm just talking about me. The most delightful thing is having my eyes opened again. Yeah. How about this? How about asking Jesus to restore your spiritual sight about the fact that you are under his sovereign care and protection? Elisha the prophet was with his servant, and they were besieged by this big enemy army. And Elisha was pretty cool. His servant was peeing his pants. And Elisha didn't go get the Depends. Elisha prayed and he said, Lord, I pray open his eyes that he may see. And the Lord opened the servant's eyes and he saw, and behold, the whole mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. He was given a glimpse of the supernatural reality of a vast multitude of angelic spirits that were surrounding the enemies that were surrounding them. And then he didn't need his Depends. Right? And we're afraid of a lot of things. I am. And one of the things we need to do when we're afraid is to say, Lord, help me to see. Help me to see the rest of the picture. And then again, we can ask him to restore our spiritual sight in terms of what the heck's wrong inside of me. Am I the only one here who regularly realizes something's wrong inside of me? The psalmist says, search me, O God, and know my heart, and see if there's any hurtful way with it. What does he mean when he says see? God already sees. He means reveal to me. Help me to see what the hurtful way is. And in that way, lead me down the right path, down the healthy path. How often, when you're all boogered up and you realize I'm boogered up inside, how often do you pray, Lord, search me and open my eyes to see what it is? Because you can't figure it out most of the time. A lot of us just waste all kind of energy psychoanalyzing ourselves and dissecting everything. We've got people who are only too glad to do that for us, and they're usually wrong too. We need to know what God sees. And then lastly, I commend to you praying for the Lord to restore your sight about other people. Jesus says he saw the people. And when he saw the people, then he saw and felt. He saw the people in a certain way, so he felt something for them. Compassion, because he saw their true state, that they were distressed and dispirited like sheep without a shepherd. He could have just seen them like I see people. You're in my way, you're annoying, you bug me, right? And a lot, if you're like me, a lot of times, you know, I'm in situations where there's all these people around me at work and in the neighborhood and church, and they just bug me, right? And so I put on the right face and fake it. But what I need to do is say, Lord, help me to see these people the way you see them. He can enable us. He can change the way we see people. That's what we need to do. Then we wouldn't have to fake it so much. Because we would have the compassion that he has, because we'd see what he sees. Yeah. Lord, I want to regain my sight. What a great prayer priority. Pretty cool. Pretty cool. There's a lot there. A lot more there probably that we missed. Next week, taking a break from the series. I haven't yet figured out how to do a question that God asked related to the birth of Christ. I'm looking for it. And so I don't even know what I'm doing, but it'll work out. It'll work out. It'll be good. Yeah, so.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.